up and immediately cross it out, because Professor Harold Bloom of Yale, who now, in the last few years, big, big book on the eighth, has flown all the way to the opposite extreme. Professor Bloom is particularly interested in and sold on romantic poetry, Blake and Shelley and Browning particularly. Bloom is therefore gets very near to saying that Yeats was at his best when, as in his youth, he can be seen most clearly as in that line of succession. Now, I think Professor Bloom is not just wrong. I also think it's a bad and careless book. And that's why I haven't put his name up. I'm going to rub it down again. because you're not recommended. But it's important to realize that this position can now be asserted and sincerely held. So that this business about Yeats's relationship with his 19th century predecessors, there has been a considerable change of opinion. And there is still room for, perhaps this is the best way to put it, there is still room for considerable difference in this matter. I think I was conditioned to think that the early collections, which are the ones that John and I are going to be looking at from the first 40 pages, are chiefly interesting as symptoms of the late Victorianism from which Yeats rescued himself. I wouldn't say that now. I think that is a way of looking at them which is valid up to a point. Some people may regard as people who can find only that value in those early poems. Well, okay. And it's a perfect and valid and understandable point of view. But I think some of those early poems, if you can accustom yourself to the late Victorian and Edwardian conventions in which they are cast, have value in their own right. So that sort of consideration is, at any rate, one that you should have in your head when you read these first 40 pages. These are, among other things, of course, the poems which you heard delivered with splendid resonance in the film that we saw. That film was very heavily weighted towards the early Yeats, the film about the Sligo country. So that's one of the things to look out for, Yeats and his English predecessors. Then Yeats and his contemporaries in London. This is what you will get partly from that essay, The Autumn of the Body, but still more in the section from Autobiographies. Even more specifically, in The Trembling of the Veil, a long chapter called The Tragic Generation. Very wonderful writing and very wonderful testimony to Yeats's humanity. His contemporaries in London, for instance, whom he speaks of, include such interesting people as Oscar Wilde, W.E. Henley, Ernest Dowson, author of I Have Been Faithful to Thee, Cynara, in My Fashion, Lionel Johnston, etc. These were the men who yes, particularly Aubrey Beardsley. The decadents and exquisites of the 1890s. This was the climate of opinion and sentiment in which Yeats first moved as a young man, still in London. And his treatment of these men, most of whom had drastically imperfect lives, when he calls them the tragic generation, he is in fact giving them, elevating them to a nobility which their careers never quite embodied. They are tragic figures, nearly all of them. They die young. Many of them die young as a result of their own sort of self-destructive excesses with drugs and drink. Wilde, of course, doesn't.
The Wilde tragedy is known to everyone and was, of course, the enormous public scandal of the time. His famous trial when he attacked for libel someone who had accused him of homosexual practices, which is a foolish thing to do since he did practice them when this came out, and he was subsequently imprisoned for a period. That is known, that you know about. Related here is something which again I spoke of very briefly, Yeats and, I spoke of Yeats and the symbol, Yeats and French symbolism. This is the period when, arguably, I think you can say that French poetry was more interesting and more powerful in the late 19th century than English poetry was. It's a period dominated by the very great figure of Charles Baudelaire, one of the very greatest poets, not just of the 19th century, but of Europe through the last several centuries. And in subsequent generations, a group of very talented poets, not an altogether homogeneous group, some or all of which have been spoken of from time to time as symbolists. Arthur Rimbaud, Stéphane Mallarmé, Paul Verlaine, Paul Valéry, and less certainly symbolists, Jules Laforgue, Tristan Corbière. Here, the book to refer to, though it's an old book now, very old book, and its conclusions need to be considerably qualified. In fact, Edmund Wilson, Axel's Castle, remarkable pioneering book. It came out in the late 1920s, establishing how much of modern Anglo-American literature, not just poetry indeed, does come out of French symbolist theory and practice. In fact, and this includes, for instance, Eliot, Pound, Gertrude Stein, as well as Yeats, and there are others whose names we'll come back to in a moment. Actually, Wilson overstates his case. Yeats's relationship with French symbolism was not as close as Wilson assumes. It hardly could have been, because Yeats appears to have known hardly any French, to tell the truth. But nevertheless, there was a relationship. And there is an influence, and this I really think you do need to know something about. And if this whole territory is entirely new to you, I do suggest that the chapter on Yeats in Wilson's Axel's Castle, old as it is, it would at any rate be a necessary starting point for those who have no notion of what French symbolism amounts. Then, Yeats and, well, we're down done with this, Yeats and his contemporaries in Ireland. And that's where we pick up Singh, particularly, Moore, to a lesser degree, and there are others who were associates, Douglas Hyde, Edwin Martin, in due course Lady Gregory. And finally, but by no means least important, is the matter of autobiographies as itself a masterpiece. Now this is a very important matter. The book was always published, the various parts of the book came out at different points in Yeats's life, his later life on the whole, as separate works. In his lifetime, he did permit them to be grouped together, five or six of them, some of them long, like The Temple of the Veil, some of them very short, under the title Autobiographies. After his death, the American edition came out with, thus, The Autobiography of William Butler Yeats. Now, that might seem to be a small and minimal change. In fact, it is
Most unfortunate.
The book
was never conceived
by Yeats as a whole. It was not
a
the story of his life. Whole
sections, periods,
and aspects of his life are left out of account altogether. What's more,
I think by giving it a
plural title,
autobiographies,
Yeats was implying,
I think,
that more than one
version was possible.
These were successive shots at making sense of the person he was and the life he had been living at various times.
The autobiography suggests, on the contrary, that this is the considered verdict.
This is the right way to look at myself and my life, as if that is what Yeats is saying.
Yeats, in fact,
never does say that, if you look.
Neither in verse nor in prose.
I have made this emphasis before,
and I shall make it again.
Yes, Yeats is an extremely arrogant man. And we've made that point,
both in his sentiments
and in his ways of expression.
He is forceful,
rather than subtle, much of the time. He does take extreme positions.
He does respond
to
pride, arrogance, and unyielding
in his heroes of the past, like Swift, like Parnell.
Nonetheless,
it is equally true that in himself
he was
always a sceptical man, and sceptical
even about himself.
And it is true to say
even that he was
a modest man. Now this paradox, or apparent contradiction, I think is very near the centre of what we have to grasp about this point. I've made the point from when I suggested, talking some time ago, and it's something that we shall take up when we get to the middle period particularly, the way in which Yeats publishes a collection of poems under a title like The Wild Swans at Cool, or Michael Robartes and the Dancer. These do not consist just of all the poems that he happens to have written since he had published his last collection. They are a selection from along those poems, and they are very carefully selected and arranged in such a way that, in fact, they echo and chime and have a dialogue with each other. Nothing is more common
than for Yeats
to write a poem and then follow it a few months later with a poem which virtually contradicts it,
and then put them close together in the same collection.
Thus, in this sense,
he was modest and sceptical.
In this sense, he was always ready to allow that I could be wrong.
I can always change my mind and argue it from another point of view if I want to.
And this is partly, this is carried,
this I take to be
very neatly
symbolised
in a term like in autobiographies with its plural title, rather than autobiography. It is, the book as a whole is,
I truly believe, a masterpiece.
Even if Yeats had never written
poems,
we would still,
I hope, be studying and honouring him for this book, which is one of the most remarkable works of memoirs of our period. And even to say memoirs is wrong. Again,
it gives you an enormous respect for the generosity of Yeats,
the magnanimity of Yeats,
and again, the modesty of Yeats.
After all,
these men are all, with the possible exception of Wilde, are in some ways failed or imperfect artists.
Yeats had been their friend.
You might suppose that he would have suppressed them from his memory, or, if he'd been a really unpleasant family
person,
that he might have written of them as
The company
that he kept and whom he surpassed.
He most notably does not do that.
He can respond to them, and they're very different people too. There's an extraordinary way in which he can respond sympathetically to a wide variety of contemporaries and, after all, rivals.
There's a very, very rare and very
pleasant and admirable absence in Yeats of what we find so often in writers of great talent.
He is not jealous.
He is not envious.
He is not continually measuring himself up against the others. He can and does appreciate them both as human beings and as artists. This is true, for instance, even about Moore, the malice that there is from it shot through against George Moore is part of an Anglo-Irish game. They enjoyed doing it to each other. It was there is no real nasty dislike or envy either in what Moore says of Yeats or in what Yeats says of Moore. Because autobiographies is a volume put together out of pieces of writing, really, it's very different one from the other, and written at different times, it's an uneven book. Certain sections are better than others. Some of them are relatively slack, I think. But when Yeats is at his best as a prose writer, his prose is really, it's absolutely distinctively his, and it is very, very splendid indeed. And it is, I believe, at its best in The Trembling of the Veil, and most particularly in that chapter, The Tragic Generation. So it's also quite various, surprisingly various. Some of it is comic and casual. Some of it is, for instance, the first section, which is called Reflections on Childhood and Youth, is very nostalgic, soft, pastel shades, and is particularly his revelries over childhood and youth. As the title suggests, is particularly concerned with his growing up in that Sligo landscape, which we saw on the film. Abundantly worth reading. It doesn't tie us immediately in with the rest of the reading, as what then follows it, The Trembling of the Veil. But even within The Trembling of the Veil, there is very considerable flexibility. You have to keep alert. Some of it is done in a grand and grave fashion, and some of it in really very sharp and pungent wit and comedy. So try to allow for autobiographies as a masterpiece in itself. Therefore, don't just treat it as something that has to be read against the clock, if you can possibly help it. Read it in its own right, as slowly as it needs. Well now, there is a lot of reading. I'd like you to get to it as soon as you can. You tell me that you're not getting to it as fast as you'd like, or a lot of you aren't, I'll cancel a couple of lectures so that you can catch up on the reading. However, we will meet on Monday with, at any rate, these pages of selected poems looked at. And I shall hope to consider certain poems from among them quite specifically, and I would hope that you would tell me which poems those are to be. I want someone to say, this is the one that I have had difficulty with. Yes, do it. No, choose to be first.
Crossways, 1889, The Rose, 1893, The Wind Among the Reeds, 1899, Endless Woods, 1904, and The Green Helmet and Other Poems, 1910. Considerably more than 20 years are therefore of this poet's life, so we should, even though the selection that we have is a very sparse one, we should be able to see a development, in fact, through these 40 pages. He does not repeat himself steadily for 20 years, not by any means. You will also notice that the first three collections, which were substantial and which made his reputation, were in fact written while Queen Victoria was still on the throne. Thus he can be regarded, quite properly, among other things, as a late Victorian poet. It was, for instance, The Wind Among the Reeds, that third collection, which particularly riveted the attention of the young Ezra Pound when a few years later he was studying in University of Pennsylvania. It was those poems in that collection which, so Pound said, brought him to London in the first place. He had decided that this was the most accomplished poet now writing in his language, and he had to go there, sit at his feet and learn. This is very striking when you come to think about it, because the Yeats of The Wind Among the Reeds, 1899, is not the Yeats that we think of when we speak of him as one of the great poets of our time. We ought to be able to recover some of the, historically, by an act of the historical imagination, some of the perception which made the young Pound quite justly pick out this man as the man from whom there were things to be learned, and to come all the way to London and to live there and to get to know Yeats in order to learn from him. Being Pound, of course, he no sooner started learning than he started teaching too. That was all right too, as far as Yeats was concerned. Right, well, I asked that the initiative, at any rate, to begin with, today, in relation to these poems, that the initiative should be with you. We shall give much more than just this one session to them, because as I explained, I put up that big reading list on Friday, I would like us not to move on into the middle Yeats before you'll have done that bulk of reading in autobiographies and in the early essays, which are contemporaneous with these poems. So you needn't feel rushed about them. We could spend quite a lot of time on this selection. Now, when I ask you which one you'd like to look at, this may need me no more than that you would like to have it read, either by me or by yourself. It's extraordinary that one has to say this, but I find that one does have to say it. A poem does not exist until it is given shape in the air. So I hope that you study the poems in that way yourself, mumbling and murmuring as you walk about. Yes.
Rosamund, upon a written comment.
Yes.
I would like to hear you read it.
Incidentally, there is a book, study aid, which I have put on reserve, Prolegomena to the Study of Yeats's Poems by George Brandon Thor, 20 years old now, which does in fact have an entry for each of the poems in the collected poems, and which will give you reference to, well, it will tell you the publishing history, which you're probably not interested in for the most part, when it first appeared, when it was reprinted, and how it was changed and revised. And will also clear up some of the obscure allusions, and also gives you a reference to the critics who have written about it. So I'll give that to you, George Brandon Thor. Okay, The Rose Upon the Root of Time. I think I'm right in saying, incidentally, just to settle the business of italics to begin with, check on this, but I think that is there as later on in the in Responsibilities on page 38, if you remember that passage which you've seen about Pardon Old Father, that still remains somewhere in earshot from the story then, which is similarly written in italics. It is purely a printed in italics. I think this is purely a printer's convention, or as it were, a framing poem which introduces the whole collection. And I think the same is true about To the Rose Upon the Root of Time. It's not just the first poem, but is, as it were, the dedication of the entire collection called The Rose. It's a particular example of the way in which Yeats, from very early on, as I mentioned before, plots and plans each collection as something more than the sum of its parts. Yes?
Couldn't the translation have anything to do with the oral fish singing?
Could what have the... What page is the Stolen Child on?
Two.
Page two. Well, yes, indeed. Indeed. But again, he often does that when he writes with a refrain, both early and late. And obviously it is meant to be sung, and in fact has been set, I think, more than once, and rather fairly often is sung. But it is, of course, purely a printer's convention. And it may even have been the printer who decided to use italics. These things are normally decided by the printer. Well, they consult the writer. But, you know, there are other ways you could do it. You could print it in capitals, if you like, in a different typeface, or indented, for instance. Yes, Judy. No, I think it is very, I think it is very relevant. Because another one, which is important, is Blue Islands in the Coming Times on pages 18-19, which is similarly printed in italics, and which similarly is an address. Not just an address, all three of these are addressed. They're in a particular sort of solemn, ceremonious address that we call a dedication. I mean, it is, I devote this body of poems to this thing, The Rose Upon the Ruin of Time, or Ireland in the Coming Times, or Old Fathers, My Ancestors, rather than Old Fathers. So that's certainly one of the things for which he uses italics, and quite rightly, a sung refrain is another way in which he or his printer decides to point it out by printing in italics. Well, I read to The Rose Upon the Ruin of Time. Red rose, proud rose, sad rose of all my days, come near me while I sing the ancient ways. Cahoolan battling with the bitter tide, the druid, grey, wood-nurtured, quiet-eyed, who cast round Fergus dreams and ruin untold. And thine own sadness, whereof stars grown old in dancing silver sandals on the sea, sing in their high and lonely melody. Come near, let no more blinded by man's fate, I find under the boughs of love and hate, in all poor foolish things that live a day, eternal beauty wandering on her way. Come near, come near, come near, ah, leave me still a little space for the rose breath to fill, lest I no more hear common things that crave, the weak worm hiding down in its small cave, the field mouse running by me in the grass, and heavy mortal hopes that toil and fuss. But seek alone to hear the strange things said by God to the bright hearts of those long dead, and learn to chant a tongue men do not know. Come near, I would, before my time to go, sing of old era and the ancient ways, red rose, proud rose, sad rose of all my days. As you see, it is very plainly a preface to the entire collection. You don't have the entire collection here, but he specifies in the first lines what are to be the subjects of the poems which follow. Come near me while I sing the ancient ways, Cahoolan battling with the bitter tide, and we have a poem about Cahoolan battling with the bitter tide, Cahoolan's fight with the sea on pages 8 to 11. The druid who cast round Fergus dreams, and that's the poem that paces it, page 7. Thine own sadness, The Rose of the World, on page 11. And then the second stanza says, come near, come near, come near, but not too near. Leave me a space to fill with. And then he specifies quite different things, really. The weak common things that crave. Weak worm, field mouse, and heavy mortal hopes. Of course, that too is part of what there is in this collection. It shows that Yeats, as early as this, is already concerned, not to say worried, in an attempt, concerned to span the whole range of human experience as he knows it, all the way from the symbolic rose, which is the rose of the Rosicrucian mysteries, and which therefore is a very arcane and esoteric symbolic matter, through the ancient mythological heroes of heroic age in Ireland, like Fergus and Cuchulainn. But he also wants to talk about common people, country people, real people of the very time when he writes. And this runs through a lot of these early poems and through his early criticism. Can he really find a style which permits him, which serves him for both of these? The whole range of subjects, from the high arcane symbolic to the common and pathetic pathos of the common day. And it would be generally agreed, I think, that he doesn't until the end of these poems that we have been reading. And this is the development which I believe we can trace of the style of that poem that I've just read. Is really fitted only for the high arcane matter of the rose, or conceivably for Cuchulainn and Fergus. It isn't really fitted for heavy mortal hopes that toil and pass. And he battles along through the next several collections, and particularly with his work in the theatre, to find a style which will encompass the whole range, which will permit him to swing from one to the other. I think that it is that by the time we get to the last poems you've been reading, Green Helmet, 1910, even indeed in Seven Woods, he has in fact found that style. Any more about this poem, or do you want another one? All right, well then, here's one that I want to look at. Yes, the first poem in The Wind Among the Reeds, The Hosting of the Sheep. Partly because this song takes us back to the film that we saw. You remember what Knocknarea is? The mountain south of Sligo, which we saw on the film several times, with its cromlech on the top, cairn on the top, in this traditional association with the mythology of Cuchulainn and Queen Maid. And indeed, we discover that there is a traditional folk memory that had certain certain in the night. Spooky times in the night, as a fairy host rides on fairy horses from through the air across the Sligo Bay from Knocknarea to Benbulben. So back again. The host is riding from Knocknarea and over the grave of Cluth na Bear, palely tossing his burning hair and near calling, away, come away, empty your heart of its mortal dream. Winds awake and the leaves whirl round. Our cheeks are pale, our hair is unbound, Our breasts are heaving, our eyes are agleam, our arms are waving, our lips are apart. And if any gaze on our rushing band, we come between him and the deed of his hand, we come between him and the hope of his heart. The host is rushing fixed night and day, and where is their hope or deed us fair? Coyote tossing his burning hair, and Neil calling, away, come away. You may well feel that the way these people are described is more like a pre-Raphaelite late Victorian painting by Dante Gabriel Rossetti than it is like that of the heroic Irish sagas. The hosting of the she, that is called 1883, the she are the spirits of, that's how it's pronounced, the spirits of ancient Irish mythology. Well, something more, rather more dignified than fairies. The fairies are diminished representatives of them. I wanted to read this in order to read with it, or rather against it, a poem from by John M. Singh in this book, which I recommended to you, Poems and Translations. This is published in 1909, and it is fairly plainly in answer to Yeats's, and in fairly irritated and impatient answer, I think. Very short, only 8 lines. The Passing of the She. Adieu, sweet Angus, Maeve, and Fand, ye plumed yet skinny she, that poets played with hand in hand to learn their ecstasy. We'll stretch in Red Dan Sally's ditch and drink in Tubber Fair, or poach with Red Dan Philly's bitch, the badger and the hare.
Would you read that once more, please?
And you, sweet Angus, Maeve, and Fan, ye plumed yet skinny she, that poets played with hand in hand to learn their ecstasy. We'll stretch in Red Dan Sally's ditch and drink in Tubber Fair, or poach with Red Dan Philly's bitch, the badger and the hare. There, I think, Singh is making it quite plain that as far as he is concerned, there is a real choice between talking about the she and Angus, Maeve, Fand, Gohulin, and expressing the actual earthly, sensual life of the Irish country people. The first quatrain says goodbye to the mythology, and the second gives you, in fact, the world which he wants to portray in Playboy of the Western World. In effect, he is saying, I think we might say, he is saying to Yeats, come off it. This style that you've got will not do for the heavy mortal hopes that toil and pass, or for the field mouse running by me in the grass. In his preface, this is 1908, Singh said, the poetry of exaltation will be almost the highest, but when men lose their poetic feeling for ordinary life and cannot write poetry of ordinary things, their exalted poetry is likely to lose its strength of exaltation, in the way men cease to build beautiful churches when they have lost happiness in building shops. Many of the older poets, such as Villon and Herrick and Burns, used the whole of their personal life as their material, and the verse written in this way was read by strong men and thieves and deacons, not by little cliques only. This is 1908. And it's a very important document, really, in the movement of modern poetry. By 1908, of course, Yeats was very closely associated with Singh, greatly admiring him, defending him and his plays and getting them put on. So that Yeats effectively, with that sort of humility which is so striking and admirable in him when he's talking about the sheer trade of verse writing, so that it coexists along with that arrogance, with that humility that he has, accepts that Singh is right. Famous anthology piece, which Yeats came to hate because it was so much the poem that was always representing him in anthologies, The Lake Isle of Innisfree on pages 12, 13. Probably you have seen it in anthologies, and in this way it gets hackneyed, but it is worth looking at it fresh, as it is extraordinarily adept, particularly metrically, and I'll read it and then ask you to define what the meat of it. The Lake Isle of Innisfree. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin built there, of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavements grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core. They're written in London, and nostalgic for Sligo.
All right, Miss Hellerstein, what's the structure of these stanzas metrically?
A very learned reply. Actually, I think it's in 6664, but I don't know where you get the 7. I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin built there of clay and wattles may. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud clay. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning to where the cricket sings. Their midnight's all a glimmer, a moon a purple glow, an evening full of the linnet's wings. I think I see where you get 7 into the second line. Well, there are a lot of syllables, but I think it is still only 6 feet. It goes dropping from the vales of the morning to where the cricket sings. In other words, there are trisyllabic feet in it. Dropping. And I actually really learned it. Because it shows how dropping from the vales of the morning to where the cricket dropping from the vales of the morning to where the cricket sings. So I got that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's an extra syllable here. Dropping the veils of the morning, which is another drop syllable, though you can stick it on there and call that an analogy, it's true if you like. This is a beautiful example of variation and substitution. Troche, anapaest, anapaest, I am. Although, for instance, the first one, or the line before, and I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, where the line is, where it's almost basically iambic, all the way along, in fact, they're all iambic hexameter. And here you get the variations. In this place, instead of this first iamb, you get a reverse foot, trochaic. Here you get a substitution of a trisyllabic foot, the anapaest. Here again, another substitution. And we only settle back into the iambic beat in the second half of the line. Similarly, the fourth line, the short line, is extraordinarily skillful. We're talking here about the fineness of the poet's ear, which is a crucial matter. And live alone in the bee-loud glade, where I really think we have to get it as and live alone in the bee-loud glade. In other words, you get what is really very rare in English, a true spondee, loud glade. And the same thing is repeated in the last stanza. I hear it in the deep heart's core. The two equal stresses in the last book, which are extraordinary resonance. There's no wonder, in other words, that this poem became an anthologist's favourite. Yeats, you will have realised, has very, very little interest, indeed, in free verse. He writes hardly anything in free verse. One might say he didn't need to when he could handle the traditional metres of this degree of flexibility. Yes, Judy.
Do you scan the